Take it away.
Well, that was really a good introduction. Thanks, Virginia.
Not Tom Takeout, but Tom Takeaway.
Yeah, my name is Tom Take It Away. I'm blind and I can't see, so. And I've been diagnosed with ADD, so this could be a really painful 20 minutes for everybody. Don't do that, Virginia. Anyway, the only reason I'm doing this is because, or the only reason I agreed to do this was because the topic was tenacity. Because I'm really not the poster child for working the 12 steps. I am a kind of a halfway decent poster child for tenacity. Again, my name is Tom. I'm 53 years old. I've been married for 28 years. I have two children. That's who I am, you know, in a nutshell. What brought me into these rooms 20 months ago basically was what Nancy had said earlier was fear. Fear brought me here. Fear has guided my life since I was, before I could remember. I think when I had conscious memories, one of the first memories I had was being afraid of something or another. I am afraid. I've been afraid my whole life. I was afraid of my father. I was afraid that I'd lose my mom's love. I was afraid of my brother. I was afraid of my sisters. I was afraid of the bullies at school. I was afraid to stand up to them. I was afraid not to stand up to them. I was afraid of my father. I was afraid he wouldn't come home from his sales trips, and I was afraid that he would, because he meant that I'd get whatever punishment was waiting with that he was going to mete out, because, you know, my mom handled the small stuff and she saved the big stuff for when he came home. So I would lay there in fear in my bed waiting for the light to come on, and I have a light. I can still see from 8 years old, I can still see the light in the ceiling waiting for it to come on, and it would invariably come on, and I was afraid. I remember the fear of anticipation waiting for the first stroke from his belt, because that's how he punished us. I grew up Catholic. I was afraid of the priest. I was really afraid of the nuns. I was more afraid of the nuns. The nuns were bigger than the priests. I was afraid of not having enough sins to confess, so I made sins up, and then I also throw in, and I lied, as the last sin that I confessed. And I think that's where part of the problem that I've had, a big manifestation of my disease is honesty, the lack of honesty. And I think that that's was part of my early training, was confession, oddly enough. I was afraid of the dark. I was afraid that the tree outside my window looked like a monster, because it did. I was afraid that I'd never have a friend who wasn't handicapped or weird. I was afraid that I'd never not be weird. I was afraid that I wasn't handsome enough, that I was too fat, that I wasn't funny or quick-witted or smart enough. I was afraid of dirt clod fights in eighth grade, but afraid not to take part because it meant I wasn't cool anymore. And the fact that I'd been invited to be in a dirt clod fight meant that I was accepted in that kind of funny way that eighth grade boys have, that I was accepted as being cool. So I scared, I couldn't throw, but I ducked. I could duck. So I'd never been cool, and I was afraid it was the only chance I'd get to prove I was. I was afraid that I wasn't athletic, and when it turned out I was, afraid that I wouldn't be good enough, or I'd make a mistake, or I'd lose to someone not as good as I, or I wouldn't lose enough weight, or the other guys would find out I was a fraud. I was afraid of contact in football, so I sought out the biggest guys to go against in drills. I was afraid of heights, so I climbed the flat irons with no ropes, no climbing experience. I was afraid of always being on the outside. I was afraid that no girl would ever like me, and when they did, I was afraid that they'd leave me, and they did, or I left them, and the one who stayed, I was afraid I didn't love her, and I did, but then I spent our life together making hers miserable because of my fear. I was afraid of letting my father, my family, my wife, my kids, my partners, my friends, my employers, my clients down. I was afraid to leave my father and his expectations for me to follow him into his business. I was afraid to try hard in school because it was easier to hide in drinking and procrastination and numb the pain than to work hard to find out, only to find out I wasn't good enough or it didn't matter because my future was ordained for me anyway. And why bother? I shot off all and any chance I had for a future apart from my father because of mediocre grades at best, in fear of leaving him at worst, in fearing that I would never have the relationship that I always longed for with him. And I was also ultimately afraid that nobody else would have me. I was afraid I'd never be good enough, and I never was good enough, but not for the reasons I thought. And now it's too late because the man he was, my father, is gone, replaced by some addle-pated shadow of the man he was. But it still didn't matter because that man was never capable of giving a shit about anybody but himself. There are a thousand other fears that have bound up my life, like the threads binding the fly in the spider's web. That's what brought me to this program. Fear has dictated my life. It's dictated every decision I ever made. You know, and I came from a family, my father spent several years of his life in labor camps, migrant labor camps. They picked crops and so forth in California and Washington and Idaho and so forth. They lived in tents. And he escaped that. He dropped out of sixth grade, ran away, spent months hopping freights, came back home, went to work for my grandfather because my grandmother quit, threw up her hands and would have nothing more, said she couldn't deal with him anymore. So he went with my grandfather who could sell ice cubes to Eskimos, as they say, and then he'd use those ice cubes to put in his alcohol and drink that down and all the money that he made along with it. At 16, my dad left him and went out on his own, found a company in Pueblo, went to work for them. By the time he was 28, he owned the company. And by the time he was 28, he also started to drink very heavily. That's when his alcoholism kicked in. My mother grew up in Edgewater. Her dad, my grandfather, was a Denver cop, and a pretty good one, but he was Irish and he drank. And one night when my mother, a beautiful 14-year-old girl with the whole world at her feet, life was turned upside down, when my grandfather, in the middle of Union Station, put 7 bullets in a man that he'd met earlier that evening and had drank with for several hours. He did it in an alcoholic blackout, something that was frequent with him. And he, till the day he died, he had no recollection that he'd done that. He escaped prison, he escaped execution, he ended up spending 7 years in the state hospital, and which brought my family to Pueblo. That's where my mom and my dad met, and that they started a family, had 5 kids, and that's what kind of started it. So my dad's dad was an alcoholic, my dad's an alcoholic, my grandfather was an alcoholic, and I grew up in a very dysfunctional family system surrounded by fear. And one of the things I feared the most coming into adulthood, even though I drank very heavily when I was a teenager in high school and through college, I knew I was not going to become an alcoholic. There are times that I've wished that I had become an alcoholic. Once I found out about 12 steps, and I found out early on, I thought, I wish I was an alcoholic because then I could go to AA and then I'd be better. Or alternatively, I wish I was an alcoholic because I would have drunk myself to death by now. So either alternative at various times of my life have looked good to me. But that wasn't the case. What was the case, and my very first addiction was food. And I can blame, again, my family for becoming a food addict. When I go to meetings, I'm a food addict and bulimic. Or I'm a bulimic and a food addict, whatever. But I learned to be a food addict at the dinner table because I grew up in one of those families that they put the plate in front of you and you weren't allowed to leave until the plate was clean. So you became very deceptive about food. You either ate it all, you sat there forever, you shoved it under the table to the dog, you put it under your plate, you wrapped it up in napkins, excused yourself to go to the bathroom, dumped it in the toilet, and came back to the table. There were any number of strategies, but again, it all led to this very unhealthy relationship with food. It's hard to know when you're not hungry anymore, when you're not allowed to make that decision. And that was the start of it with food. When I was 10, I became very body conscious, mainly because my dad pointed out that I was getting a little fat. And at 10, I started holding in my stomach. I'm 53. I've been holding in my stomach for 43 years. I'm holding in my stomach now. I don't really necessarily need to hold in my stomach. I don't know any other way to do it. It's a small thing, but it's a huge thing. At 16, in high school, I'd outgrown that baby fat. I'd become, you know, a very fit young man. I played football. I wrestled. I was successful at both. And at 16, a friend introduced me to vomiting. I didn't know, I didn't hear the term bulimia for years. What I did was I threw up. I ate and I threw up. And that worked for me. I thought that I had pulled one off on the world. I could have my cake, I could eat it too, I could have some more cake, I could eat it, I could have some more, and so forth. And it was just this cycle that started. And for the first 10 years, I was a bulimic. I didn't see anything wrong with it. I thought it was just a cool little parlor trick. I could go to the bar, I could drink a pitcher of beer, I could go to the bathroom, get rid of the pitcher of beer, I could come back and drink another pitcher of beer and then ad infinitum. And that's what I did. And then at some point in my late 20s, mid or late 20s, I started to realize this isn't normal. Other people don't do this. And I began to realize that something was wrong, but I never associated it with an addiction. I never thought of it as a disease. I just thought there was something wrong with me. And when I was 25, I began going to therapists. And over the next 25 years, I went to at least a dozen different therapists. I've been diagnosed ADD, I've been diagnosed bipolar, I've been diagnosed depressed. And none of that made a difference. I've talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. And not one of those therapists, and not one time did anybody say, you know, maybe you're an addict. Maybe you should check out 12 steps. Maybe you should go to OA. Maybe you should do this. And I'm not blaming them. I just think that's the level that there is a lot of information lacking in the mental health professions. I just think there is. That's based on my experience with literally a dozen different therapists in three states over 25 years. I took all the drugs there were, from Prozac on up. I took several for ADD, I took several for depression, I took several different ones, always looking for the silver bullet, always looking for that magic pill that would make everything better, and it never did. It never did. And I'm not saying I'm not a better person because of therapy. In many ways I am, but it never addressed the core issue, the core woundedness within me. And always, and there was, I had my companion of bulimia, you know, I'd eat and I'd throw up. I go to a friend's house. I check out the bathroom. I'd flush the toilet to make sure it would flush. Because the last thing I wanted to do was to go in their bathroom after eating their meal, flush the toilet, and be staring at a bowl full of vomit. And I know that's graphic and that's gross. It is gross. And that's what I did. And that's how I lived. And that was the insanity. And I would do that over and over again. We have friends the woman is a marvelous cook. And I'd go over, and I would throw up as many as four times in a night, just in and out, and in and out, and in and out. It was insanity. And it wasn't the only addiction. Somebody mentioned earlier, struggling with multiple addictions. I mean, it's all one big disease, and mine has different faces. There were other aspects. If it wasn't the food, it was addiction B, or addiction C, or addiction D, and I'd cycle through them. And I never could pinpoint just one thing, because there were four things, there were five things, there were six things. If I could get it, if there was any chance or possibility at all of being addicted to something, I could become addicted to it, and I did. I chew tobacco for another habit I picked up in wrestling. Mothers who have sons who wrestle, there are some really unpleasant habits you pick up. And I chewed tobacco, and again, you know, I thought, well, at least I don't smoke cigarettes. And it was hidden, and I could do it. I've been in meetings with Fortune 500 executives, because at one time I sold systems to Fortune 500 executives, where I had a big wad of chew in my mouth, and nobody knew. Nobody knew. And that was the nature. I never wore my weight. I threw up my weight. That's the nature of my addiction. Look good on the outside, be rotten on the inside. That house, it looks lovely till the inspector comes and finds that it's riddled with termites. That was me. And that's how I've lived my life. Always, always, always looking for an answer. Therapy didn't work, although I continued going to therapists. Finally, I went, you know, in the 90s, I got into evangelical Christianity. For a while, I convinced myself that it wasn't me, it was Satan. And I went through all these programs to pray Satan out of my life. And, you know, and nothing ever worked. And then my wife brought to my attention a book. The book led me to a 12-step program, not this one, a very small one, a phone one. They're too small to have their own literature. They use OA literature. They also suggest that members, if they want personal contact, go to OA meetings. And almost 2 years ago in April, I walked into Shepherd of the Hills meeting at 6 o'clock. Just no idea that I had a food addiction, wondering how I was going to answer the question of who I was and what I was there when it came around. And everybody started talking, and all of a sudden the light turned on. And then somebody said, oh, you should go to the 4:30 meeting. It's you got a bulimic focus. And I went to that one. And I thought, you know, finally, I found my tribe. And that's, and I've hung out there for the last, more or less, 20 months. And it's not been, you know, working my program has not, again, as I said at the beginning, I'm not the poster child for working a program. My program mainly consisted of, I got abstinent from the vomiting the day before I went to my first meeting. I've been absent for 20 months with that. But all my other... The only reason I say that is so I can get applause. But everything else has still been present in my life, and I haven't made a whole lot of effort to be absent anywhere else. I stopped being bulimic. I just became an overeater. Oh, boy. I started gaining weight again. Then I lose weight, and then I start gaining weight. So now I relate to, you know, everybody in OA. And the thing of it is that I thought, okay, well, I'll get a sponsor. I've had 3 sponsors in OA. I've had maybe 3.5. The first one fired me. The second one, we kind of broke up. And the third one is kind of ongoing, and I'm grateful for it. But I needed to do more than that. I needed to do more. I started doing service. I do the website. I until recently did the newsletter. And thank God I did service. Nancy spoke about service. Service is the only thing in February, March, and April of this year that kept me in OA, that kept me in 12 steps. I would have left. I got into my shame. I got to the point. I did something, not in this program, but I felt like I betrayed the trust of somebody in another 12-step program. And I said, oh, I've got to leave 12 steps until I get better, and then I'll come back. But the connectedness, because I couldn't leave OA because I was doing the newsletter, and I was doing the website, and I was doing the email, and I was like, how could I leave? I had to go to intergroup. So I left it, but I didn't leave it because I was still connected to all these wonderful people. And eventually I got over myself, I got over my shame, and I went back into the rooms. And that led me to another 12-step program that addressed one of my big hairy addictions. And 3 weeks ago, this program, they have a tradition of giving a first step, a formal first step in front of the group. And the group always has 40 or 50 people. And they're mainly men. And people from the start have said, isn't it kind of weird for you to be a man with all these women around you? And to be honest with you, no. I've always been nurtured by women. Men have always wounded me. I don't feel comfortable with men. I don't. And now I'm there 3 weeks ago doing a first step. And the only reason I agreed to was because I said, I have to do this. Otherwise, I'm not going anywhere. I'm just spending my wills, going to meeting after meeting after meeting with no real recovery. I went to that meeting, uncertain even to the last minute if I'd actually show up for it. I gave this first step, and it was amazing. It was really amazing. And what I did before the meeting was I realized I had to be abstinent in that particular facet of my addiction. In addiction C, or addiction B, let's call it, I had to be abstinent in that. So 2 days before I gave my first step, I just quit acting out. So I went into that meeting sober. So now I've got two down, two to go. I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm okay with that. And what happens with this disease? It fools you. It says, yeah, you can, you know, we'll put these two on the sideline. And I start spending more and more time with my other addictions. The food was still bad. I'm overeating. My addiction B, I'm still acting out in. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, you can't have recovery without abstinence. Abstinence is not recovery. But you can't have recovery without abstinence. And there may be people who disagree with me and people's experience is different. But for myself, I realized the big epiphany for me 2 weeks ago was I can't have recovery without abstinence. So I quit everything else. Today I can stand in front of this meeting and I'm abstinent. I'm abstinent for a week, for 10 days, for 3 weeks, and for 20 months. That's my abstinence. And it scares the hell out of me, because my addictions covered up or hid me or protected me. I hid from my life behind my addictions. I avoided facing my life. I avoided facing the fear by immersing myself in my addictions. And now all I have is me and life, and I don't know what to do. Except I got another sponsor. I started working the steps. I've done the first step. I'm working on my second step. I have this sense of lightness that I can do that I'm unencumbered right now of the guilt and shame of carrying my addictions into recovery, because you can't do that. That's a burden that's too hard to bear for me, in my experience. I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that I've finally taken my first steps on the road to recovery in this program, and I owe it to everybody here, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.